After the bombing of Iraq began, along with the bombardment of public opinion, the polls showed overwhelming support for Bush's action, and this continued through the 6 weeks of the war. But was it an accurate reflection of the citizenry's long-term feelings about war? The split vote in the polls just before the war reflected a public still thinking its opinion might have an effect. Once the war was on, and clearly irreversible, in an atmosphere charged with patriotic fervor, the president of the United Church of Christ spoke of the steady drumbeat of war messages, it was not surprising that a great majority of the country would declare its support. Nevertheless, even with little time to organize and with the war over very fast, there was an opposition, a minority for sure, but a determined one, and with the potential to grow. Compared to the first months of the military escalation in Vietnam, the movement against the Gulf War expanded with extraordinary speed and vigor. That first week of the war, while it was clear most Americans were supporting Bush's action, tens of thousands of people took to the streets in protest in towns and cities all over the country. In Athens, Ohio, over 100 people were arrested as they clashed with a pro-war group. In Portland, Maine, 500 marched wearing white armbands or carrying white paper crosses with one word, Y, written in red. At the University of Georgia, 70 students opposed to the war held an all-night vigil, and in the Georgia legislature, Representative Cynthia McKinnon made a speech attacking the bombing of Iraq, leading many of the other legislators to walk off the floor. She held her ground, and it seemed that there had been at least some change in thinking. Since Representative Julian Bond was expelled from the very same legislature for criticizing the war in Vietnam during the 1960s. At a junior high school in Newton, Massachusetts, 350 students marched to City Hall to present a petition to the mayor declaring their opposition to the war in the Gulf. Clearly, many were trying to reconcile their feelings about war with their sympathy for soldiers sent to the Middle East. A student leader, Carrie Baker, said, "We don't think bloodshed is the right way. We are supporting the troops and are proud of them, but we don't want war." In Ada, Oklahoma, while East Central Oklahoma State University was adopting two National Guard units, two young women sat quietly on top of the concrete entrance gate with signs that read, "Teach peace, not war." One of them, Patricia Biggs, said, "I don't think we should be over there. I don't think it's about justice and liberty. I think it's about economics. The big oil corporations have a lot to do with what is going on over there. We are risking people's lives for money." 4 days after the United States launched its air attack, 75,000 people, the estimate of the Capitol Police, marched in Washington, rallying near the White House to denounce the war. In Southern California, Ron Kovic addressed 6,000 people, who chanted, "Peace now." In Fayetteville, Arkansas, a group supporting military policy was confronted by the Northwest Arkansas Citizens Against War, who marched carrying a flag-draped coffin and a banner that read, "Bring them home alive." Another disabled Vietnam veteran, a professor of history and political science at York College in Pennsylvania, named Philip Avillo, wrote in a local newspaper, "Yes, we need to support our men and women under arms, but let's support them by bringing them home, not by condoning this barbarous, violent policy." In Salt Lake City, hundreds of demonstrators, many with children, marched through the city's main streets chanting anti-war slogans. In Vermont, which had just elected socialist Bernie Sanders to Congress, over 2,000 demonstrators disrupted a speech by the governor at the State House. And in Burlington, Vermont's largest city, 300 protesters walked through the downtown area, asking shop owners to close their doors in solidarity. On January 26, 9 days after the beginning of the war, over 150,000 people marched through the streets of Washington, D.C., and listened to speakers denounce the war, including the movie stars Susan Sarandon and Tim Robbins. A woman from Oakland, California, held up the folded American flag that was given to her when her husband was killed in Vietnam, saying, "I learned the hard way. There is no glory in a folded flag." Labor unions had supported the war in Vietnam for the most part, but after the bombing started in the Gulf, 11 affiliates of the AFL-CIO, including some of its more powerful unions like steel, auto, communications, chemical workers, spoke out against the war. The black community was far less enthusiastic than the rest of the country about what the U.S. Air Force was doing to Iraq. An ABC News Washington Post poll in early February 1991 found that support for the war was 84% among whites, but only 48% among African Americans. When the war had been going on for a month, with Iraq devastated by the incessant bombing, there were feelers from Saddam Hussein that Iraq would withdraw from Kuwait if the United States would stop its attacks. Bush rejected the idea, and a meeting of black leaders in New York sharply criticized him, calling the war an immoral and unspiritual diversion, a blatant evasion of our domestic responsibilities. In Selma, Alabama, which had been the scene of bloody police violence against civil rights marchers 26 years before, a meeting to observe the anniversary of that bloody Sunday demanded that our troops be brought home alive to fight for justice at home. The father of a 21-year-old Marine in the Persian Gulf, Alex Molnar, wrote an angry open letter published in the New York Times to President Bush. "Where were you, Mr. President, when Iraq was killing its own people with poison gas? Why, until the recent crisis, was it business as usual with Saddam Hussein, the man you now call a Hitler? Is the American way of life that you say my son is risking his life for the continued right of Americans to consume 25% to 30% of the world's oil? I intend to support my son and his fellow soldiers by doing everything I can to oppose any offensive American military action in the Persian Gulf." There were courageous individual acts by citizens speaking out in spite of threats. Peg Mullen of Brownsville, Texas, whose son had been killed by friendly fire in Vietnam, organized a busload of mothers to protest in Washington, in spite of a warning that her house would be burned down if she persisted. The actress Margot Kidder, Lois Lane in the Superman films, despite the risk to her career, spoke out eloquently against the war. A basketball player for Seton Hall University in New Jersey refused to wear the American flag on his uniform, and when he became the object of derision for this, he left the team and the university and returned to his native Italy. More tragically, a Vietnam veteran in Los Angeles set fire to himself and died to protest the war. In Amherst, Massachusetts, a young man carrying a cardboard peace sign knelt on the town common, poured two cans of flammable fluid on himself, struck two matches, and died in the flames. 2 hours later, students from nearby universities gathered on the common for a candlelight vigil and placed peace signs at the site of death. One of the signs read, "Stop this crazy war." There was no time, as there had been during the Vietnam conflict, for a large anti-war movement to develop in the military. But there were men and women who defied their commanders and refused to participate in the war. When the first contingents of U.S. troops were being sent to Saudi Arabia in August of 1990, Corporal Jeff Patterson, a 22-year-old Marine stationed in Hawaii, sat down on the runway of the airfield and refused to board a plane bound for Saudi Arabia. He asked to be discharged from the Marine Corps. "I have come to believe that there are no justified wars. I began to question exactly what I was doing in the Marine Corps about the time I began to read about history. I began to read up on America's support for the murderous regimes of Guatemala, Iran under the Shah, and El Salvador. I object to the military use of force against any people, anywhere, anytime." 14 Marine Corps reservists at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, filed for conscientious objector status, despite the prospect of a court-martial for desertion. A lance corporal in the Marines, Eric Larson, issued a statement. "I declare myself a conscientious objector. Here is my sea bag full of personal gear. Here is my gas mask. I no longer need them. I am no longer a Marine. It, to me, is embarrassing to fight for a way of life in which basic human needs, like a place to sleep, one hot meal a day, and some medical attention, cannot even be met in our nation's capital." Corporal Yolanda Hewitt Vaughn, a physician who was a captain in the Army Reserve Medical Corps, a mother of three young children, and a member of the Physicians for Social Responsibility, was called to active duty in December 1990, a month before the start of the war. She replied, "I am refusing orders to be an accomplice in what I consider an immoral, inhumane, and unconstitutional act, namely an offensive military mobilization in the Middle East. She was court-martialed, convicted of desertion, and sentenced to 2.5 years in prison. Another soldier, Stephanie Atkinson of Murfreesboro, Illinois, refused to report for active duty, saying she thought the U.S. military was in the Persian Gulf solely for economic reasons. She was first placed under house arrest, then given a discharge under other than honorable conditions. An Army physician named Harlow Ballard, stationed at Fort Devens in Massachusetts, refused to follow an order to go to Saudi Arabia. "I would rather go to jail than support this war," he said. "I don't believe there is any such thing as a just war." Over 1,000 reservists declared themselves conscientious objectors. A 23-year-old Marine Corps reservist named Rob Calibro was one of them. "My father tells me that he's ashamed of me. He screams at me that he's embarrassed by me. But I believe that killing people is morally wrong. I believe I'm serving my country more by being true to my conscience than by living a lie." An information network sprang up during the Gulf War to tell what was not being told in the major media. There were alternative newspapers in many cities. There were over 100 community radio stations, able to reach only a fraction of those tuned into the major networks, but the only sources, during the Gulf War, of critical analyses of the war. An ingenious radio person in Boulder, Colorado, named David Barsamian, recorded a speech by Noam Chomsky made at Harvard, a devastating critique of the war. He then sent the cassette out to his network of community stations, which were eager for a point of view different from the official one. Two young men in New Jersey then transcribed the talk, put it in pamphlet form, in a shape easily photocopied, and placed the pamphlets in bookstores all over the country. After victorious wars, there is almost always a sobering effect, as the war fervor wears off, and citizens assess the costs and wonder what was gained. War fever was at its height in February 1991. In that month, when people being polled were reminded of the huge costs of the war, only 17% said the war was not worth it. 4 months later, in June, the figure was 30%. In the months that followed, Bush's support in the nation dropped steeply as economic conditions deteriorated. And in 1992, with the war spirit evaporated, Bush went down to defeat. After the disintegration of the Soviet bloc began in 1989, there had been talk in the United States of a peace dividend, the opportunity to take billions of dollars from the military budget and use it for human needs. The war in the Gulf became a convenient excuse for the government determined to stop such talk. A member of the Bush administration said, "We owe Saddam a favor. He saved us from the peace dividend." New York Times, March 2, 1991. But the idea of a peace dividend could not be stifled so long as Americans were in need. Shortly after the war, historian Marilyn Young warned, "The U.S. can destroy Iraq's highways, but not build its own, create the conditions for epidemic in Iraq, but not offer health care to millions of Americans. It can excoriate Iraqi treatment of the Kurdish minority, but not deal with domestic race relations, create homelessness abroad, but not solve it here, keep a 500,000 troops drug-free as part of a war, but refuse to fund the treatment of millions of drug addicts at home. We shall lose the war after we have won it."